All right, before I forget, I was working in Acts. I got to show you this. Acts 13 and verse 16. So I can prove biblically that my sermons are just like the Apostle Paul's. Look at this, three things. Acts 13 and verse 16. So Paul does three things here. He stood up. He gestures with his hand, and he speaks. See? Three things. See? So my sermon, just like Paul's. Right? You didn't know that, did you? But now we have biblical evidence. So I got bogged down today on the gesturing thing, because it's a different Greek word. Greeks had different gestures for public speakers. And one was to keep people silent, and the other one was to say, I'm going to be talking. And it was just, it's like handshake with certain people. You got to, which way do you want me to shake? But anyway, so now you know. I don't know if that will fly real well with some people, but at least there's 3 points to it in verse 16. So, and now I'm standing up, and I gestured, and I'm talking. So. It's contagious. It's like insanity. It's hereditary. You get it from your children. So it's true. So, all right. Enough of that. What's that have to do with Ezekiel? I don't know. But what?
We'll find out.
We'll find out. There's got to be a roundabout here. All right. Ezekiel chapter 10. And you can see there the just some things that the summary is the glory of God ascends into the air from the temple threshold. But the key word that's found in chapter 10 is the word, well, in English we pronounce it cherubim, cherubs. Doesn't the King James sometimes say cherubims, which is like saying appleses? A plural of a plural. So we don't need multiple plurals, but cherubim would be the Hebrew word, Hebrew pronunciation, but it's found 22 times in this chapter. So that tells us that's a pretty big item, right? Kind of look for those things. And the other thing is chapter 10 echoes an awful lot of chapter 1 and the display of the glory of God. So keep that in mind as well. So verses 1 and 2, we have instructions to the seventh individual. Ezekiel records, "Then I looked, and behold, in the expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim, something like a sapphire stone in appearance, in the likeness of a throne, appeared above them, and he spoke." Now, let me stop there. He spoke in the, all the cool kids have this translation, but in the Legacy Standard Bible, they've gone back to the old habit of capitalizing pronouns that apply to God, which is, I like that. I think that's a really helpful thing. But nonetheless, he spoke, takes us back to chapter 9 and verse 4. "And he spoke to the man clothed in linen and said, enter between the whirling wheels under the cherubim and fill your hands with coals of fire from between the cherubim and scatter them over the city. And he entered in my sight." So as Daniel Block says here, the wheeled vehicle transporting the throne of God has become the bearer of judgment. So, and again, when you think of the throne of God as a believer, right, you say, wow, someday, right? Revelation 4 and 5, we will see the very throne of God. And that can be a matter of great hope for us. But here the throne of God is a vehicle of judgment. Jerusalem is literally burned with fire in 586. You can read about that in 2 Kings 25. So that's probably a reference to that. Just a symbolic, or a, should say a vision of what is to come. Verses 3 through 5, and again, remember this. This is God's house, right? The temple is where God has chosen to dwell. In fact, it is later in the gospel accounts that Jesus refers to the temple even without the glory cloud. He says, "You have made my Father's house," right? A den of thieves, a horrific place to be. But he still called it my Father's house. So it's interesting how one thinks about something impacts how one speaks about it. But it says in verse 3, "Now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the house when the man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court." Now, in Hebrew, on the right side, not always, but normally when we talk, when it has to do, how do I want to say this? When it's giving directions, not so much two people standing next to each other, but it's when you're talking about directions, when something is on the right side, it's on the south side. Okay, it's assumed you're looking east. Okay, we assume with our maps, right? Well, normally, we look north, right, when we look at our maps, right? Now, your GPS on your vehicles, you can adjust that to whatever you want to do on that. But not all world maps have done that, right? But for Israel, the people of Israel, east was straight ahead. On the right was the south, okay? So, now, what we're talking about here then with the Temple Mount, the larger Temple Mount, and then the actual temple. So if there was this wall which seems to have been there, and the idol of abomination was at the north gate, right? Now the glory cloud has come on the south side, okay? Distancing itself, if you will, or I shouldn't say itself, I should say himself, because the glory cloud is a reference to a person, not a thing. So the throne chariot parks on the south side of the temple. The cloud first entered the temple back in 1 Kings chapter 8. So that would have been in the latter 900s BC. So it's been there for 300 years in this temple, right? Am I doing that right? Doesn't Solomon become king like in 970? BC, and if we're looking at roughly 586, not quite 300 years, right? Or no, it's more than that. It's almost 400 years. I'm so good at math. Pushing 400 years that God has lived in this house. Okay? Yeah, it's extremely important for what's about to take place here. Verse 4. End of verse 3, and the cloud filled the inner court. And then the glory of Yahweh rose up from the cherub to the threshold of the house. And the house was filled with the cloud. And the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of Yahweh. So no longer is it just a glowing cloud of over the Holy of Holies, or this pillar of fire and this pillar of cloud, but now it encompasses this whole thing. And if, now I know Solomon's temple was not as large as what Herod enlarged the Temple Mount, but in Jesus' day, the Temple Mount could hold upwards to 250,000 people. Okay? It's a lot of people in one place. Now, again, Solomon's temple was smaller than that. However, the point is that this glory now, the brightness of the glory of Yahweh fills the entire courtyard of the temple. Now, again, practically speaking, what does that do? It lightens everything that's in the temple. What does that do? Then it shines light on all of these false gods and goddesses that are being worshipped in the temple. Right? So not only do we have this increased light, verse 5, moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court. And Ezekiel tells us, which to me is not extremely helpful, but Ezekiel writes this like, well, yeah, duh. But he says it's like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. I don't know what that sounds like. But Ezekiel could tell, that's how he describes that. Now, exactly, is that, again, you mentioned some time ago, you know, you think of Moses and Charlton Heston, and you think of the voice of God, right? And God's always got just, well, maybe. I don't know, right? We do know in the Gospel of John that when God spoke, they thought it thundered, right? Is that like a, I don't know whose voice sounds like that. Is that James Earl Jones who talks like that? I don't know, but Sam Elliott. I don't know what it is, but it's, Ezekiel writes this, it's like everybody should know what this, that's his reference, right? Whatever that is, I don't know. On the top of page 17, Ezekiel's experiences now are both visual and audible. And notice his title for God here is God Almighty, which is El Shaddai. Right? And I think the definition that's most helpful for me on El Shaddai is the God who is enough. Now, enough strength. Okay, we like that one, right? He's powerful. Or is he enough to satisfy the human soul? If he is that, then why are they worshiping these false gods in his house? But didn't Jesus say that if people come to Christ, they would never hunger or thirst again? El Shaddai, the God who is enough. So, verse 6 through 8 tells us that it happened that when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim, he entered and stood beside a wheel. And the cherub, singular, sent forth his hand from between the cherubim to the fire which was between the cherubim, took some up, put it in the hands of the one clothed in linen, who took it and went out. And the cherubim appeared to have the form of a man's hand under their wings. So the transfer of the coals of judgment. Now this man clothed in linen is obedient, does exactly what he's told. And then we have, beginning in verse 9, a reference back to chapter 1, I think, a description of this throne chariot, the whirling wheels, the beating wings. You get the idea of somewhat of a hovercraft, and somehow it, with these gyroscopic wheels on the four corners. And I looked, and behold, four wheels beside the cherubim, one wheel beside each cherub, and the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of a Tarshish stone. And you're all supposed to go, oh, wow, that's, right? But again, Ezekiel's people would have gone, oh, sure, right? And we're just like, okay, right? As for their appearance, all four of them had the same likeness, as if one wheel were within another wheel. As they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went, but they went in the direction which they faced without turning as they went. And their whole bodies, their backs, their hands, their wings, and their eyes were, and the wheels were full of eyes all around, and the wheels belonging to all four of them. And the wheels were called in my hearing the whirling wheels. And each one had four faces. The first was the face of a cherub, the second face. Again, you're supposed to go, oh, okay, right? What does that look like? We don't know, right? But Ezekiel was like, well, everybody knows this, except for Americans. The first face was the face of a cherub, the second was the face of a man, the third was the face of a lion, and the fourth was the face of an eagle. When the cherubim rose up, and they and the living creatures that I saw by the river Kabar, now as the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. Also when the cherubim lifted up their wings to rise from the ground, the wheels would not turn from beside them. When the cherubim stood still, all the wheels would stand still. And when they rose up, the wheels would rise with them. For the spirit of the living creatures was in them. So there is this, what I used a bigger word here, synchronistically, right, where they worked together, right? They went at the same time. So you get the impression that something is about to happen. You have the light, you have sound, you have movement. And then we have verse 18. And then the glory of Yahweh departed from the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim. And when the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them. And they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the house of Yahweh. And the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them. So he has moved from the south gate, south side, over to the east side. And there's, you get the impression of this anticipation, this imminency, that something is just, this is, in the movies, this would be the music that's just getting you, you know, and the scene has gotten either darker or bright, whatever they do with in movies to increase your anticipation, right? Verse 20, these are the living creatures that I saw beneath the God of Israel by the river Kabar, so I knew that they were cherubim. Each one had four faces, each one had four wings. And beneath their wings was like the likeness of human hands. And as for their faces, they were the same faces whose appearance I had seen by the river Kabar. Each one went straight ahead. Now, we stop, Ezekiel stops here and leaves us hanging, right? He gets us to that east door, and then he introduces in chapter 11 some more reasons for the destruction of Jerusalem. So there's this delay. And what is about to happen, and again, this is hard for us to grasp in our culture, but when you go out that last door, right? This is holy space, right? This is not. This is profane space. This is common space. This is holy. This is the holy place. This is the holy of holies. And as you get out of the holy place, you get into common ground, right? You get into profane ground. Now, it's interesting that what we're going to see in chapter 11, what is on the, and this is not, I have to explain, this is not topographically accurate. So, but on the east side, you have a range of hills. Okay? You got that? Or else the Indians have come up with teepees here. But there's this range of hills here, which is the one we're most interested is the Mount of Olives. Okay? But if you're here in the holy place, in the temple, and you look to the east, that's as far as you can see. You can't see anything beyond, right? Because this range of hills here is and ranging from 300 to 500 feet higher, okay, than the city of Jerusalem. So your view to the east is blocked. Now again, Psalm 121, I will look unto the hills. Where does my help come from? Right? You can't see any further to the east. Now if you get up to the Mount of Olives, you can see seemingly forever, right? You can see probably nigh unto 30 to 50 miles to the east, okay? But if you're in Jerusalem, you can't see. That's extremely important in this. And so when the glory cloud has now shifted, there's this anticipation, will he go out the door? Will he leave the holy place? Can God leave the holy place? And if he does leave a holy place, what happens? Right? You understand the theology going on in their hearts and minds is that's never happened before. Right? You can see all the rabbis and well, could and but the reality is it looks as if that's going to happen. What does that mean? What does that mean to me individually? What does that mean to us corporately as a nation? What does that mean to the temple? What does that mean for worship? What does it mean at night? All my entire life and the lives of my parents and the lives of my grandparents and my great-grandparents and on and on back, we have all gone to bed in Jerusalem with that night light over the temple. And what if that leaves? Okay? There's, again, it's not just the light, right? We know that. It's not just the glow on the highest part of the city of Jerusalem. It is the visible manifestation of the presence of God. But could that leave? Now, if you haven't read chapter 11, right? So you, it's still, well, maybe he won't leave. He's just at the door. Maybe it's just going to be a Minnesota goodbye, and he's going to be there for a really long time, right? But we don't know. So that leads us, let me point out, while this is point number two under letter F, while the modern readers know the end of the story, right, if you've read Ezekiel, you know that the glory actually returns. Right? But if you're reading this for the first time, right, you're hearing this read for the first time in synagogue, and right, because you're not in Jerusalem, you're in exile, and Ezekiel's talking about this. Imagine the sadness, and that's too shallow of a word, isn't it? For this, it's just not. Oh, I scuffed my new shoes. Or I scratched my new vehicle. Or I burnt the toast, or, you know, whatever else makes us sad, the Vikings are playing again, right? Kind of a thing. It's more, obviously, sadness is not a deep enough word. I don't know what word you would use to describe it, but it's a sense of grief, a sense of abandonment. If Yahweh goes out that door, who will take care of us? I will look into the hills. Where does my help come from? Psalm 121, my help comes from Yahweh. But what if he leaves? Will Yahweh's departure, Abner Chu says, by the way, if you ever come across, and I don't know how much he's written, but some of the stuff that I have that Chu has written has been really good. Will Yahweh's departure end his relationship with his people? I mean, that could happen, right? If a wife has been unfaithful to her husband in their own home, in their bedroom, while the husband is home, right? We had that illustration last week, and that's what's happened with Israel, with their God. And the husband walks out the door. Where does that leave the relationship? Right? So some things you really need to think through. Now some would say, well, it's just not fair that God would do this. You know, he's making them feel bad. You got the wrong view of God, and you got the wrong view of sin, and you got the wrong view of people. God has redeemed this people. God has protected these people. He has poured out his grace and mercy upon this people and has been patient with this people and has warned this people for hundreds of years. But there comes a time when he says, this city will be destroyed because of your sin, because of your spiritual, not just spiritual idolatry, but spiritual adultery. Right? Which is, by the way, is what James refers to Christians in James, the book of James, when he refers to people struggling with sin is adulterers and adulteresses. Now, before we go on, and I have, and maybe you have as well, you hear people say, well, if God was just visibly present with me, it would be so much easier for me to obey. Read Ezekiel. Was God visibly present in the temple? Answer is yes. And what did the people do? They just didn't sin in their homes. They brought their sin into God's very house and then sinned in God's house in light of his glory cloud. Right? So the visible presence of God does not necessarily guarantee a person's obedience. Right? I mean, the disciples had the visible presence of God, right, in the person of Christ. And yet, what did they do even on their way to Jerusalem the last time? They're whining about who will be the greatest, right? They're sinning even there. Judas even betrays Christ and sells him. So the visible presence of God is not necessarily the deterrent for sin. Adam and Eve in the garden, right? And the voice of God is perambulating through the garden. And what do? They go and hide and blame and excuse. So I think Ezekiel then puts chapter 11 here, especially verses 1 through 13, to say, if you need more evidence, if you need exhibit 870 quadrillion and seven reasons why God should do this, here's another for instance. Verses 1 through 4. Moreover, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the east gate of the house of Yahweh, which faced eastward. And behold, at the entrance of the gate there were 25 men, and I saw among them Jaazaniah, the son of Azur, and Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, officials of the people. And he said to me, Son of man, these are the men who devise wickedness and give evil counsel to this city, who say the time is not near to build houses. The city is the pot, and we are the flesh. Therefore prophesy against them, Son of man, prophesy. So what transpires here is Ezekiel addresses the sins of the leaders head on. These are men of influence. These are men who are extremely wicked, men who encourage others with a false optimism, a pseudo-optimism that they are immune to Yahweh's judgment. Oh, it's okay. God will not punish you. God's a God of love. He's not going to discipline. He's not going to judge our city. Don't listen to Jeremiah. Right? Don't listen to Ezekiel. Don't listen to these prophets. The time for destruction has arrived, even though the corrupt leadership thinks they are invulnerable. And the Spirit of Yahweh, verse 5, fell upon me, and he said to me, Say, thus says Yahweh, so you say, house of Israel, for I know what comes up in your spirit. In other words, what? He is the knower of the hearts, right? He is omniscient, which is one of the things earlier in chapter 8 that they were saying God does not see. Well, he does too. In fact, he sees more than you can see. All you can see is external. Isn't that what the issue was with man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart? Same concept. You have multiplied your slain in this city, and you have filled its streets with them. Therefore, thus says the sovereign Yahweh. Thus says Adonai Yahweh. Your slain whom you have laid in the midst of the city are the flesh, and the city is the pot, but I will bring you out of it. You have feared a sword. So a sword I will bring upon you, Adonai Yahweh declares, and I will bring you out of the midst of the city and give you into the hands of strangers and execute judgments against you. You will fall by the sword. I will judge you to the border of Israel, so that you shall know that I am Yahweh. This city will not be a pot for you, nor will you be the flesh in the midst of it, but I will judge you to the border of Israel. And thus you will know that I am Yahweh, for you have not walked in my statutes, nor have you executed my judgments, but have executed according to the judgments of the nations around you. So the people have delighted in violence and will be dealt with violently. Some of these leaders will be brought to northern Syria to meet with Nebuchadnezzar. You can read that in 2 Kings 25. And they will be judged. Which leads us on the top of page 18, the verse number 13, Ezekiel's prayer. And now it happened as I prophesied. that Pelatiah, the son of Benaiah, died. So, a confirmation of Ezekiel's message. Now look how Ezekiel responds to the death of this wicked individual. I fell on my face and cried out with a loud voice and said, "Alas, Adonai Yahweh, Sovereign Yahweh, will you bring the remnant of Israel to complete destruction? And are you going to destroy everybody in Israel?" Then verse 14 through 25. "And the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, your brothers, your relatives, your fellow exiles, and the whole house of Israel, all of them, are those to whom the inhabitants of Israel have said, 'Go far from Yahweh, this land has been given to us as a possession.' Therefore," in other words, there's a distorted view of why some are in exile. Verse 16, "Therefore say, thus says Adonai Yahweh, though I had removed them far away among the nations, and though I had scattered them among the countries, yet I was a sanctuary for them a little while in the countries where they had gone." So again, was it Assyria? Was it Babylon? Yeah. But it was also God, right? God used the Assyrians, God used Babylonians. "Therefore, thus says Adonai Yahweh, I will gather you from the peoples and assemble you out of the countries which you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel." So in other words, there is hope. "And when they come there, they will remove all its detestable things and all its abominations from it. And I will give them one heart and give within them a new spirit. And I will take out the heart of stone out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh." In other words, a sensitive heart. Verse 20, "Why? So that they may walk in my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, then they will be my people and I will be their God." Now, that is partially fulfilled with Ezra and Nehemiah. We worked through that a while ago. But it is still not ultimately fulfilled. And I've given you their New Covenant references that will be fulfilled. Verse 21, "But as for those whose hearts walk after their detestable things and abominations, I will give what is due for their way on their heads, declares Adonai Yahweh." So there are some who will remain unregenerate. And we see that again, Ezekiel, Nehemiah, right? Ezra and Nehemiah. So having given this prophecy of judgment, but also given a prophecy of partial restoration, that leads us to verses 22 through 25. "And then the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them." Now that's an expression I heard in a sermon the other day, and I haven't taken the time to pursue this, but the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the deep, right, in Genesis 1, and this concept of hovering, and I want to pursue that sometime. Maybe you already have, and you can enlighten me on that. But so the Spirit, the glory of God is hovering, "and the glory of Yahweh went up from the midst of the city and stood over the mountain which is east of the city." It's Mount of Olives. "And now the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in a vision by the Spirit of God to the exiles in Chaldea. So the vision that I had seen went up and away from me, Then I told the exiles all the things that Yahweh had shown me. Now, you're in Israel, and you have seen the glory cloud transition. It's out of holy space, right? It's on the mountain. And Ezekiel doesn't go any further with that at this point. But the glory cloud has moved. And the glory cloud will not return until what Ezekiel writes 20 years later in chapter 43 and elsewhere. But Zechariah 14, I think, also references something along this line as well. But I hope you get the, you grasp the tension and the apprehension in the hearts of the people who are watching this transpire. The glory cloud belongs here.
It's always been there.
Yes, in your lifetime. It's all you've ever known. It's all your parents ever knew. It's what all your grandparents ever knew. And on back to the time of the time of King Solomon, 1 Kings 8. But now the glory cloud is over here. And if it's over here, if you're in here, what do you have at night? You have darkness, right? For the first time in your entire life. Now, when Jesus comes into the temple, right, they have, isn't it four? I think there are weren't there four massive pillars, giant lampstands in the temple? It was the Jewish leadership of the temple. It was their attempt to give light. Right, they had to come up with something to enlighten the courtyard, and then somebody had to carry olive oil up there, right? And yet it is Jesus who says, what? I am the light of the world. Right? You can pour all the oil you want into those giant lampstands, but you still have to put more oil in. And eventually it's all going to burn, right? They had the Shekinah glory cloud for all those years. What did we come up with? 400 almost years. Did it satisfy their souls? No. And so they produced the imitation light in New Testament times. That doesn't satisfy their souls. And then the light of the world comes to them and they reject him. The problem is not the light, right? The problem is the human heart. And Israel, as we've seen this evening, until that prophecy is completely fulfilled, right? Until that prophecy that says, verse 17, I will gather you from the peoples and assemble you out of the countries from which you have been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. And when they come there, they will remove all its detestable things and all its abominations from it. Now, I know there's a debate on this, but I think in what Ezekiel is saying here, that this regathering of the people of Israel, which will take place, because God says it will. And I've wrestled with this over my Christian lifetime. Because you hear people say God is going to gather Israel in faith. They're going to come in faith. I don't think so based on this. They are gathered, then they are given a new heart. That makes sense. He says, I will gather them from the peoples. I will assemble you out of the countries from where you have been scattered. And you're going to come into this land. And then I will give you, or give them a new heart, and give within them a new spirit. So I think there's going to be a regathering. Now, maybe we can't separate them quite as nicely as we would like. But it certainly seems that God can gather them. Where am I going with this? Then, is the regathering of Israel to the land of Israel today a fulfillment of prophecy? Could be. Because it doesn't have to be in that they have been restored and they are coming as saved individuals. But the regathering can take place, and then the salvation takes place once they have been regathered. Unless I'm misreading his sequence here, but to me, that's what at least the chapter 11 here of Ezekiel would seem to indicate. There is this sequence, a regathering and then a regeneration. We're not going to solve that this evening, but think about that. So that leads us to the middle of page 18 for our notes, and we'll stop there.